And welcome back. April is Donate a Life Month, 4 weeks set aside to remind Americans to sign up to donate organs, eyes, and tissue to help save lives. The numbers verify the need. 120,000 people are awaiting organs. 21 die every day while waiting. 2,500 transplant surgeries were performed last year, but there are only between 1,200 and 1,300 donors. That's a pretty stark disparity. Joining me in studio to talk about what's going on locally is Dr. William Chapman, the surgical director at Washington University and Barnes Jewish Transplant Center. Doctor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Don. It's great to be here today.
Do our numbers in St. Louis pretty much match what's going on locally in terms of percentages, do you think?
Well, we have a large transplant center here. Mm-hmm. We're pretty fortunate in the Midwest that we have strong organ donation rates, and that's both for cadaveric donors, some people who have died but have are willing to donate, as well as for living donors. So generally, we have people who are very supportive of patients in transplantation, and it's something we continue to encourage, but it has really helped out many people here.
The numbers nationally really are, as I mentioned, quite stark. I mean, when you only have a few hundred donors and the need is so tremendous.
The organ donor rates are actually nationally a little bit higher, but the need is way greater than the number of donors we have. So we'll have every year about 6,500 organ donors. The amazing thing is many of those donors will be able to have 6, 7, 8 organs from a single donor that will provide a life-saving transplant for a recipient, either here locally, around the state, around the region, and sometimes nationally. The problem we have, and it's in some ways a good problem to have, but it's a problem, the organ transplantation has become so successful that we're now able to help more and more people. And our waiting lists are growing faster than our donation lists. So we've created a gap. We have more than 120,000 people waiting on a list. And not all of those will have their chance at a transplant. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the tragic part we work to get around.
Sure. You talk about having become so successful over the years. What is the reason for that success? What has been going on to make it so successful?
Well, there are, as you can imagine, it's happened for a lot of different reasons, and it's a little bit different for each area of transplantation. So some of the biggest hurdles actually had to do with the surgery. The surgery can be technically challenging. And from the time organ transplantation started really in the 60s, the first 20, 30, 40 years, it was really more about can you technically put patients to sleep safely, put them on bypass if they need it, get them through the surgery. And so that was some of the first big hurdles. Second big hurdle has been immunosuppression. How do you treat the recipient in a way that they continue to live a normal, healthy life but don't reject the new organ as foreign? And we still have some challenges in that area, but it's substantially improved. It's a much lesser problem than it was even 10 or 15 years ago. So those two things have helped us a lot: perfect the surgery, improve the immunosuppression, and then it's just general medical care. We're all living longer. We're taking care of all the other diseases that impact patients who have organ failure.
What is the most common surgery? Is it
for transplant?
Yeah.
No, it's actually kidney transplantation. There'll be over 15,000 kidney transplants a year. We have a big gap. As you know, we have so many patients on dialysis who one will live longer off of dialysis with the transplant, but secondly, have a much better quality of life with the transplant in general than being on dialysis. So kidneys first. Liver is probably second with around 6,500 or 6,000 liver transplants a year. Heart and lung are less. And pancreas is probably the least common. But those are the most common solid organ transplants. There are patients who, a very small number, but who importantly need intestinal transplants. Mm. They don't have enough small bowel, so they can't eat. And, you know, you can live without eating, but you can't live a very good life without eating. And think about that. So that's a very small number of patients in need, but it's an important area. Those really make up the solid organ transplants that we consider in this category.
Well, aren't you doing a lot of work with lung transplants at Barnes?
We are. We have, you know, I think last year we were the number six center nationally when considering all of these solid organ transplants. So we're a high volume, I would say very successful center. Our lung transplant program has been in existence since around 1990 and is one of the larger centers in the U.S., usually performing about 70 to 75 lung transplants a year. So it's a big area of focus.
We've been hearing a lot in recent years with regard to the role that stem cell technology, yes, if you will, is playing in this whole field. And most interestingly, there's a piece on NPR this morning, as a matter of fact, about 3D printing and the fact that that's being used now in your field. Could you talk about each of those for a moment?
Well, both of these areas are under investigation and have significant promise. So, you know, some of the ideas are, here we are with this great shortage of organs. Could we develop an organ scaffold, for example, use stem cells and repopulate a scaffolding and make a liver a kidney?
Can we just explain the scaffolding part of it? I'm thinking of something going up the side of a building.
Yeah, well, the scaffolding idea is, you know, we already can isolate out liver cells. So you can take a liver either from a person or from a you could make a pig liver, for example, be relatively compatible. Could you take those isolated liver cells and put them in a network? The scaffolding would be like the backbone, mm-hmm, shaped like a liver, that would take on the function of a human liver. We're probably a significant ways away from doing that, but I think it's very conceivable. And, you know, I bet in time it will happen. It's a matter of how long. So could we use those strategies of using a 3D printer to actually print the backbone of the organ and then use stem cells to populate that scaffolding? There's work being done on this. I think it will happen. I don't know when.
I just wonder if 50 years ago when this was getting started, any of the people who were early on in the field, the DeBakeys of the world, for instance, or Christian Barnard, we're thinking along these lines. I mean, this is so out there, it seems to me.
Well, it is out there. Yeah. You know, I remember as a kid when the first liver transplants were performed, and the prevailing view, not only in public but also amongst physicians, were that this was an impossibility. It was a pipe dream. We'd never be able to successfully perform liver transplants. And it took a lot of years. It took a lot of perseverance. Dr. Tom Starzl led the way, and it became reality. So I think, yes, it's a pipe dream, but it is not that far-fetched an idea.
I'd like to open the lines to our listeners if you'd like to get into this conversation, talking about organ transplants and where we are today. We're talking with Dr. William Chapman, the surgical director of Washington University and Barnes Jewish Transplant Center. If you'd like to get in, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer to send a tweet, we'll take that at STL on air. What about the expense of all of this, Dr. Chapman? It's always been called a very, very expensive process, particularly with regard to those drugs, those anti-rejection drugs that you were talking about before. It's an expensive deal.
It is.
Are those prices coming down? Costs coming down?
Costs are coming down, and what's allowed costs to come down are The way we've streamlined patient care, patients are in the hospital a much shorter period of time. The medications are becoming less expensive. You know, these patents that are pretty expensive, they expire and then generics become available. We're using generics for selectively, not all of them, but some of the immunosuppression drugs. What's really more impressive to look at the details, yes, a kidney transplant is expensive, but you know what? Dialysis is way more costly. So if you look at the cost-benefit analysis, the chronic disease without a transplant in most settings is much more expensive. So not only is it life-saving, not only do these transplants vastly improve the quality of life, but they're cost-effective. So it makes sense, even from that point of view.
There is a perception out there, and I don't know how widespread, but it certainly exists, that if you are someone, celebrity, wealthy, you have a better chance of getting a transplant than others who are don't fall into those categories. I think of Dick Cheney. That's been mentioned with regard to his heart surgeries. I think of Mickey Mantle, the baseball player. He got a liver a lot faster than other people. What about that? Is there anything at all to this?
Well, you know, when this take Mickey Mantle, for example, when he had his transplant, there were concerns publicly expressed that, oh, he got this transplant early. And this gets looked into. You know, it's not me. It's not our surgeons or physicians determining where patients are on the waiting list. We have a very rigorous process where yes, there is differences in the time that patients wait, but usually that's based on how sick the person is and their objective criteria. You cannot jump the list. That really cannot happen. So you know, that gets brought up, but I'm not aware of any evidence that that's ever happened.
I would think that proximity to the donated liver would have something to do it too, with it too, perhaps.
Well, there are variations in transplantation across the country, and so we do have waiting lists based on where patients live. It's not practical to say we're going to utilize donor livers from Alaska in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. We have limits on the time that the liver can be out of the donor before it's sewn into the recipient. So all other things being equal, we prefer and work towards and today have locally donated organs going to locally needy recipients. And that makes sense.
Sure. Sure it does. Let's take some calls. We have some people who want to get into this discussion. Let's bring them in. We'll talk first with Kristen calling from St. Louis. Kristen, go ahead, please.
Hi. My uncle, Aaron Cameron, was, I think, one of the oldest living liver transplant recipients. I think he's going on 30 years that he's been alive and back with us thanks to the work that you all are doing. So first, thank you so much because he's the oldest living member of our family. And to pay it forward, I actually tried to be a living donor of and donate my kidney to someone because I have O positive blood and I heard that was hard to get, but I was turned down because I have celiac disease. And so I wondered if you could speak to whether there are any medical advances that are being looked into to allow people like me to donate and give a living donation.
Well, thank you very much for your call. You know, the Barnes program opened in 1985, so I'm sure your uncle, that's 30 years ago, was one of the very first transplants. And it's great to hear how well he's doing. One of the things I would just emphasize is we expect these transplants to last for life. In other words, as long as a person otherwise needs it. And for a liver, it should last as long as needed. As far as your question is concerned, that is sometimes a challenge when individuals want to and are able to donate but have a medical reason preventing it. What I would tell you, and I don't know the specific details in your situation, but one of the things that we and I think every center in the U.S. works really hard to be certain of is that the donor is not disadvantaged in any way. So if you're a living donor, we expect there's process. We expect if you give up a kidney, well, we know this is not going to help your health at all. All you can do is lose from a medical point of view. So we've got to be certain that the procedure is going to go perfectly if it can, and usually does. And secondly, that you have no future health adverse events. So we don't want to have this jeopardize long-term care in any way. So, for example, patients with diabetes, you know, most of the time, because that can cause kidney injury, we don't want to put the donor at risk in case they need two kidneys. Normal, healthy individuals will do fine for the rest of their life with only one kidney. So it's great that you want to donate. It's really for the protection of the donor that if there's any concern, then we say we better find another donor.
Thanks for the call. Let's bring in Mike calling from Swansea, Illinois. Go ahead, Mike. Mike, are you there? Apparently not. But Mike, I think, wanted to talk about the age relative to donations. Is there a problem here? Is an older person equally acceptable?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad that Mike called with that question. Today, and we've had improving experience over time, donors at any age may be suitable. So we have found, for example, that older donors in their late 70s and even in their 80s can be an acceptable liver donor. So we have many recipients who are older also. When we've looked at this, you know, in the 20 years ago, we'd say if a donor's older than 60, for sure, that's not going to be suitable. And what we found over time is that organs will work even in elderly ages. So we encourage everyone who is willing to sign up to be an organ donor, and many will be able to do that. The other aspect I would mention is we're not only talking about organ donation, there's tissue donation. So bone grafts, tendon, other tissues can be utilized. And so between the organ donation and the tissue donation, almost everyone can be a donor.
Just to clarify, would you have any difficulty taking a 60-year-old liver and putting it in a 20-year-old body?
Well, the answer to that is no, if we really needed it. So we sometimes have situations where we have young people, a 20-year-old who is, we know we only have a day or two or three, and we're, you know, the clock's ticking and we've got our backs up against the wall. And in those situations, and we have done that, we have had to do that, and those organs have worked perfectly. In general, we would try to match an older donor to someone within 20 years of the older donor. So if it's a 70-year-old, you tend to put it, if you could, not use it in a 20-year-old, although the evidence today would suggest that liver will last as long as that 20-year-old needs it. But to be a little bit on the safe side, we would try to have it a little bit closer in age.
Well, what are the biggest challenges you're facing in the field right now?
In the field of transplantation,
yeah.
Well, you know, we still deal a little bit with rejection. What's tended to happen is because of the successes of the transplants, from a surgery point of view, from an early function point of view, what we're now facing challenges is some of the side effects of the immunosuppression. So we know that some of the immunosuppression, for example, will cause kidney injury. So you get a liver transplant today, and 10 or 15 or 20 years from now, you may need, and it's about 15 or 20%, may need a kidney transplant.
Well,
so one of the things we're working on is developing a what we call tolerance so that the recipient will fight off infection, not be too immunosuppressed, but not reject that organ and be able to come off of immunosuppression. I think that'll happen. If we can do that, we'll reduce a lot of the challenges of transplant today. That's one challenge. Another major challenge is having enough organs available to help our recipients. So, you know, this is a big challenge. We cannot help everyone. We cannot help everyone who needs help.
Potential donors, I think, are subject to some misinformation. And I know there are a number of myths that are involved in this area. And that's one of them. People think that if they just simply say on their driver's license that they're a donor, that that's enough. That may not be enough, correct?
Correct. I would definitely. I'm glad you brought that up, Don. Yes, signing your driver's license is nice, but really you need to do more. And that is let your family know. Let your family know you've mm-hmm. signed up. You know, when someone has a tragedy, and this is unfortunately always a tragedy when someone has a death, but they still have usable organs and they're willing to be a donor, it's incredibly stressful for the family. If the family doesn't know the wishes of the individual, it can be very difficult for them to proceed with donation. Let your family know, number one. Number two, sign up on the organ donor registry. So we now have a registry. It becomes immediately available. The organ donation teams can know it, and that really helps to move the process along.
We'll put some more information on our website at stlpublicradio.org and link with you and yours with regard to the work that you're doing there if folks have further questions. Dr. Chapman, thanks so much for being with us. It's a fascinating field. I've watched it from the beginning and can't believe some of the things that are happening today.
Thank you, Don. It's been a great privilege to be here. Thank you.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about how strong and creative leadership can shape metropolitan areas in a more inclusive, equitable, and sustainable directions. Then we'll take a look at two museum exhibits related to Nazi propaganda at the Missouri History Museum and the St. Louis Holocaust Museum and Learning Center. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.